go. So today is March 7th, 2012. I'm Rick Hansen, for the record. As you may know, we post these talks, so they're available usually within a week at the most, typically sooner than that, on my website, rickhansenson.net. So if you want to listen to this talk or share it with anybody else freely, you're welcome to do that, and it should be posted, as I said, in a few days. You may know that I just came back from nearly a month of retreat. I was able to do the great bulk of the February retreat at Spirit Rock Meditation Center, which is a wonderful place to practice one way or another. It's really my home base. It's probably where I want my ashes scattered, you know, which is one way to say, you know, what a place it means to you. And how many of you have ever been on at least one night of a meditation retreat? Okay, that's great. So 24 nights was small potatoes for a lot of people who've done three-month retreats or three-year retreats. But for me, it was my longest retreat ever. And I'm comfortable with retreat practice. I like meditating. I'm comfortable in that environment. And even for me, it was a stretch. It was very interesting. One thing that was almost humorous to experience was there I was marinating in well-being. Just a wash, every molecule in my body kind of quivering with quiet bliss, total relaxation, ease, the state of mind that we work 50 weeks out of 52 so we can have a two-week vacation to experience some minutes of, right? Or that we do what we do as a means to the end, really of quality of life, you know, that particular experience. So there I am having that experience. And what would my mind from time to time do? It would turn to, gosh, I'd really like to be doing emails right now. What? You know, like my mind would want to go to the things that are means to the end of that particular state of mind, even as I was in a wash in, really, that taking baths in that particular state of mind. And it just goes to show one of the topics I want to get into tonight, the power of clinging, the power of that perseverative quality that keeps persevering in the mind to grasp after something new and different, to seek some form of becoming. So tonight, what I thought I could do is, in a sense, interrupt the sequence that I was on before I went on retreat, which was going through the Buddha's seven factors of awakening. We got through mindfulness and investigation. The sequence would have been energy. I think I'll do that next week when energy goes to how to generate energy, and of course, how to use it, how to use energy for what's wholesome and helpful, and how to reduce energy for what's not helpful or wholesome. That'll be next week. But I just thought it would be silly to not share with you some of the juice that I got from that retreat experience. So I'd like to talk with you tonight about the three, I would say three major highlights for me on the retreat, which were my three themes tonight: clear comprehension, not clinging, and love. And speaking of love, I can't go further without thanking Linda Graham for doing the last four sessions here focused on the Buddha's divine states of mind, or sublime abidings of mind, the Brahmaviharas, so-called, of compassion, kindness, altruistic joy, and equanimity. And Linda, I've heard already from multiple sources, it's always good when it's more than one, multiple sources just did a wonderful job here, very heartfelt. And so I want to thank you again for doing that. So first, clear comprehension. And I thought what I could do is talk a bit about each one of these sections, then we could talk a bit about it, then I'll just keep going. And I'll keep my eye on the clock and try to end close to 8:30. So mindfulness, pure mindfulness, which is probably the fundamental foundational practice in Buddhism. The Buddha said that mindfulness is, when carried to its umpteenth degree and really concentrated and perfected, is a fully adequate vehicle for taking anyone, male or female, monastic or householder, all the way to complete liberation. So mindfulness. What is mindfulness? The root of the word for mindfulness in the language of early Buddhism is sati, which is recollection. There's a recollected quality to mindfulness. So with mindfulness, we are persistently, recollectedly, metacognitively, in other words, there's an awareness of awareness, we are persistently present with some experience. That's mindfulness itself. What goes along with mindfulness is clear comprehension, with the Pali word sampajana. And what clear comprehension means is it's not simply that we're barely present, but that there's an ongoing knowingness of what is there. So we know what things are, or we know where we are. And there's a continuity in clear comprehension of present moment awareness that's inclusive and spacious. Now, I'd heard about clear comprehension many times. I thought, oh, okay, so you kind of have a basic notion of what's up around you. I had barely scratched the surface. And on the retreat, my own practice, which has tended on retreats to drive into concentration in a very muscular, effortful, doing kind of way, my strong suits, I instead just intuitively went into and was encouraged to go into a much more receptive state of just letting life land and staying present in that process. The trick is, of course, to stay present, and that's what I'll talk about momentarily. So when we're in a state of clear comprehension, there's moment-to-moment present awareness of what we're doing, what our hand is doing, how our body is leaning, what our words are doing, and what the state of mind is at that time, what's present in awareness. Why do clear comprehension in the first place? Well, for one, it keeps you out of trouble. If you're aware in the moment of what you're doing and thinking and feeling and actually saying and why you're doing these things, it helps you head trouble off at the pass, and it also helps you gently incline your mind in a more positive direction. A second benefit to clear comprehension is that it strengthens mindfulness itself. A third benefit to clear comprehension is that it keeps you in the present. If you think about it, and this is a theme I'll pick up on, where we suffer typically in terms of tension or stress or frustration or fear is related to the future or the past. When we come into this moment, most moments are perfectly all right in and of themselves. And actually, when your mind is really present in this moment, and awareness is honestly like, almost call it, think of it as a windshield through which the traffic of life is moving, right? Instead of moving through time, time is moving through you, moment by moment. Sounds are arising and passing away. Sights are appearing. Thoughts are coming and going. Sensations are arising and passing away. It's incredibly rich. This moment is incredibly rich. So being in this moment, which is incredibly rich, one, tends to undo worrying and planning and regretting and resenting. Good. Second, it is so full this instant that it tends to undo craving. We don't want anything else. We're really okay in this moment. Or, as in the example I just gave about myself, when other tendencies arise to want to be processing emails, God forbid, it seems a little absurd against the backdrop of the fully satisfactory, in a sense, nature of this moment, as long as we don't cling to it, which I'll get to in a bit. The fourth benefit of clear comprehension is that it really helps you start to see, especially when you do any kind of formal practice like meditation or extended practice like a day somewhere or even 24 nights or a whole month, or people right now who are continuing, my brothers and sisters on retreat from the February retreat into March who are doing two months total. So when your mind is relatively quiet, or even just now and you're clearly comprehending, you can really start to see how rapidly experiences disappear, how transient experiences are, how ephemeral they are, and you can start to see into their, in some ways, almost transparent or insubstantial nature, which I'll get into in a moment. And when you start seeing that increasingly, time after time, you develop an emotional conviction around it that really serves not clinging, which, as I said, I'll be getting to. So clear comprehension. Very, 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 very important. You know, how to do it. Well, variety of ways. One is to try to come into the present again and again and again. Second, be in the body. You know, that was a deepening teaching for me about being in the body. There's a quote from a fully, generally considered a fully awakened person, Ajahn Mun, M-U-N, who is the teacher of Ajahn Chah. Ajahn's an honorific, like rabbi, and so forth. Ajahn Mun was the teacher of Ajahn Chah, who is the main teacher for Jack Kornfield and Joseph Goldstein, in Sharon Salzberg in many ways, and the whole lineage of Vipassana teachers in the West. And Ajahn Mun, if you ever have a chance to go to Spirit Rock and go to the Gratitude Hut, which is on the road, just kind of right near the community meditation hall, there's a photograph of him that's just amazingly intense. He's just looking in the camera and you can feel the transmission. He says in this quote, I'll paraphrase a bit, in all your investigations, never forget the body. And as you are present with the body, more and more deeply over time, you will see the body coming and going. And as you experience more deeply the sensations of the body coming and going, you will find a profound peace. That's essentially a paraphrase. So that's another way to come into clear comprehension, staying with the body. A third way is to know why you're doing something before you're doing it. I would do this practice over and over again at breakfast. It was amusing, where I would not move unless I knew why I was moving, literally. And it's interesting to eat a meal. I encourage you to try to do it. Or any little thing tonight for a short period of time that's fairly automatic. In other words, you'll start to really come into the present if you ask yourself, why am I doing this before I do it? And then know why you're doing it, and then do it. That's clear comprehension. So I'd be eating, my mouth full, right? The Spirit Rock, with all this vegetarian food, you tend to pack it away to get some sense of volume in your body, because it's, you know, it's like adventures in digestion there, trust me. But anyway, my mouth was full, and I'd watch my hand digging up another spoonful that it was going to hold for a minute while I finished chewing laboriously all that kale and chard and wholesome brown rice and tofu, exciting. Anyway, the food there actually is really good in some way. Why is my hand doing this, you know? No comprehension. Walk down a road. There you are. Within seconds, you'll find yourself no longer walking down that road, but lost in thought, no longer clearly comprehending this moment. So knowing why you do something before you do it, that's another way to stay in the present. Another way is to really try to sustain awareness of the whole body or the whole field. In other words, walking through a room, feeling like you're moving in a sense at the center of a kind of bubble of recognition of what's around you, the volume of space you're moving through. Or right now as you sit, having a sense of your body as a whole rather than attention be dominated by just one part of it. Little detail here, when we're in a state of clear comprehension, we're in largely a state of open awareness, which activates neural networks on the sides of the brain, mainly the right side for right-handed people, and half of all lefties, roughly. Then what happens, alas, routinely, is that networks in the middle of the brain hijack that open, spacious awareness and suck us into a little thought bubble about what we're going to do tomorrow, or a dinner we had a week ago, or there I'd be really marinating in well-being, and suddenly I'd find myself caught up in some recent episode of Grey's Anatomy. I don't like Grey's Anatomy. It's like soap opera with doctors, but my wife loves it, so we watch it. It's a togetherness thing. But anyway, there I am in Grey's Anatomy. You know, Meredith Grey, her problems. What? Okay, that's the midline networks of the brain, the so-called default network that twirls us into these little reveries of various kinds. All right, so one way to sustain lateral network activation, and thus open spacious awareness, and thus clear comprehension, is have a sense of the gestalt, things as a whole. Another way to sustain activation of those lateral networks and thus clear comprehension is a panoramic view And one way to do that, which is a double benefit, is to get a sense of awareness as a space. You can even do this right now, maybe a second or two at a time. You can have a sense of phenomena, in a sense, arising within and passing away inside a larger field, like clouds coming and going in the sky, birds coming and going, little sparks of light. Sensations are like little sparks of light in this vast space of awareness. And that, too, will take you out into those lateral networks. Okay. Oh, and the last thing is to be receptive. You know, as soon as we start getting into planning or worrying, we tend to lose clear comprehension of the whole and lock on to some small part. But if we can stay in a quality of life coming to us, receiving life, relaxing, it's just life, enjoy the show, you know, of each moment of experience as it rolls through awareness. That too will take us into clear comprehension. All right, any question or comment about clear comprehension? Great. Mindfulness? Yeah, it's great. Mindfulness is just pure attention. You may not know anything about what it is, but you're attentive to it. Clear comprehension has more of, if you know the aggregates in Buddhism, that model at all, it has more of the perception function, where we know what a thing is. So clear comprehension is, I'm walking down the road. I know it's daylight. I know this is asphalt. I know I'm walking. I'm feeling my body walking. It's this body. There's a comprehension of the whole. So in other words, in a sense, comprehension is what fills the space that mindfulness creates. It's the knowing. There's a knowingness to it. It's not simply a bare witnessing. It's more textured. It's richer. It's deeper. It has, in a sense, we're in the moment, but it's a moment that might have a 1 to 3 second duration, a kind of a moving window in which there's a knowing and a continuity of knowing. Great. Very, very good. And when we're doing practices like I'm describing, you know, like an awareness of the whole, mindfulness and clear comprehension kind of blur together. Okay. Maybe I'll keep going just in the interest of time. So clear comprehension itself is great. I got a lot of value from that. I still do. Another way into it is light noting. In other words, from time to time, in other words, every few seconds, or especially if your mind starts to wander, just note, oh, Gray's Anatomy. Oh, wanting coffee. They don't have a lot of coffee at Spirit Rock. You have to bring your own. Oh, hard-boiled egg, eating egg. Oh, you know, just noting, oh, missing my family. Oh, leg falling asleep. Oh, that kind of little noting tends to bring you back into the moment. Okay. So, as I said, one of the things that you start to see when you're more in a state of clear comprehension is the relentlessness of clinging and its results. So, a bit of a review for some people, the Buddha pointed out, which is really confirmed by Western psychology and neuropsychology, that there's this ongoing sequence in the mind produced by the brain in which there's a stimulus called contact in Buddhist psychology, which has a hedonic tone of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, called the feeling tone in Buddhist psychology, which then leads naturally to craving. In other words, there's a wanting that starts to emerge, wanting the pleasant to continue and grow, wanting the unpleasant to decrease or disappear altogether. All right? And then that craving tends to become more involved, engaged, and committed, and it shifts into clinging. Gotta, which then leads eventually or momentarily to suffering. What's the problem with clinging? This is the second noble truth of Buddhism, that the fundamental root of suffering is clinging. In this life and in the Buddhist cosmology, the clinging that leads to life after life, which contains suffering. Okay? The Buddha didn't say that life is only suffering. Right? He just pointed out that in the balance sheet, there's actually a lot of suffering, especially if you include the wide range of the meaning of suffering in Buddhist, in Pali, which is dukkha, which includes subtle tension, strain, and the subtle incapacity of any moment of experience to be truly satisfying, because it's gone as soon as it arrives. Okay. So clinging leads to suffering. Clinging does also lead to suffering because it feels contracted in the moment we do it. It also causes us to take positions or act in various ways at kind of the macro level that harm other people or ourselves. You know, we hold on to viewpoints, positions, righteousness. That's one. We attach to views. We cling to views. We also cling to certain experiences. We don't want certain experiences. We cling to avoiding them. We avoid the dreaded experience and shrink our life to a very small space in order to avoid risking dreaded experiences. That's a form of clinging that's profoundly central to human unhappiness and to any kind of therapy. We also tend to cling to routines, what the Buddha called rites and rituals. Right? Things have to happen in a certain way. There needs to be a certain sequence. There's certain proprieties. There's certain rules, certain shoulds or musts. That's a kind of clinging. And then last, deeply, we tend to cling to the notion of self, me, myself, and I. So, do you like me? Right there. And you can see the degree to which self is woven into so many of the little thought bubbles moving through the mind. It's the implicit subject or protagonist of these little thought bubbles. It's the ultimate stake on the table. What's the point? It's kind of, you know, has to do with what do you think of this I purport to be? Okay. How do we undo clinging? That's the heart of Buddhist practice. And I would say that was the second major takeaway for me. I came to believe, actually, that, you know, biologically, with an animal's brain, as we all have in this room, it's natural to have feeling tones of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. It's even kind of natural to crave, in the sense of wanting, to move from liking to wanting. You know, I think with deep practice over time, even much wanting falls away. We continue to want things that are wholesome, but unwholesome wanting falls away. But near term, in the intermediate zone of practice that I personally consider myself to be in, and I think most of us in the room are in, you know, in this zone, I think actually where we have a lot of opportunity for intervention is around clinging. In other words, want it, but find a way to be deep down at peace with whatever happens. That's the release of clinging. To be fundamentally okay with not being able to have it. That's the release of clinging. So how to release clinging? You know, my little just one thing, I'm going to talk about some ways to do it. I'll summarize a few. We do it in a variety of ways. One, take care of basic needs. In other words, biologically, a brain that feels basically safe and protected and basically content with its fundamental goals being achieved and with some sense of success or an agency and accomplishment in the world, and a brain that feels loved and cared about and included to reasonable degrees, maybe not necessarily with the ultimate perfect mate, but basically okay, a brain then reverts or defaults or settles into its natural resting state. I call the responsive mode of the brain. That's a basic state of fundamental peacefulness, happiness, and love. And in that state, there's much less inclination to crave or cling. So taking care of basic needs, very important. And animating a kindness for ourselves as one of the all beings, you know, that we should be kind to. Another way to reduce clinging, where am I here, is to pick something kind of macro, large, that you know you're kind of getting your knickers in a twist about, right? You're caught up about, you're chasing, you know, trying to get blood from a stone, or you're trying to get cheese in tunnels that don't have cheese anymore. You know, it's a terrible saying, but it's from sales training, which I used to have back in the day. Don't send a duck to eagle school. Maybe trying to fly like an eagle with a duck. You know, or realize that you're never going to get what you really want from this particular job or this particular trip with your kid. I've had a lot of lessons about realizing that the conditions were just not present for success, for some good result down some particular path with my kids. They just weren't present. The conditions were not present. No praise, no blame. They just were not present. Whatever it is, pick something, maybe, at a macro level that you're clinging to that you know is problematic. Maybe you're clinging to too many sweets, too much alcohol, too much dope, too much something. And pick it, and then for a minute, an hour, a day, or the rest of your life, if you like, help yourself be at peace with not having it. Even potentially relinquish it. The radical undoing of clinging is renunciation, sometimes translated maybe better as relinquishment. We just set it down. We set it down, and before we pick it up again, we really ask ourselves, do I really, really, really want to pick that up again? Okay. At the more micro level, and that it takes a certain amount of clear comprehension and mindfulness to do this, at the micro level, a very powerful way to undo clinging is to look directly at your own experience of something rather than the objective reality that image or sight or sound is representing. And this can get a little heady, and I'm going to try to keep it to the ground. So